Good day. Today is Monday, 13th July 2026, and as you can see, I'm back in my room in London following a short but intense and extremely enjoyable holiday in Montenegro, where together with my family, I celebrated the wedding of two very dear friends, creating memories which will last with us, with all my family, forever. Anyway, having come back to London, however, we have to get back to the discussion of the news and the commentaries about the news, which is the purpose of this channel. And of course, we have situations in the Persian Gulf and in Ukraine. The war in the Persian Gulf appears to be intensifying again, and there have been all sorts of positions staked out by the two sides. But I propose in this program, again, to focus on what is ultimately actually the bigger war, which is the war that continues to take place in Ukraine. And, well, the important event in that war, in some respects at least, was another appearance by the Russian president, Vladimir Putin, at a conference of a Russian organization called the Russian People's Popular Front. He addressed their annual congress and he made certain comments about the state of the war. Now, I should say that the Popular Front, the Russian Popular Front, was an organization that was set up about 15 years ago, around the time when there were protests in Moscow following a disputed parliamentary election, which took place in 2011. There was a lot of excited commentary at that time in the West that the protests would expand and lead to a political crisis and to the fall of Vladimir Putin. You get this kind of narrative in the West all the time. We had it many times before, and of course we've had it even more and to a much more sustained extent since. But anyway, the Popular Front was then set up by Putin and other senior members of the Russian leadership in order to provide the Russian leadership with a mass organization that they could call on in the event that there was a sustained attempt at some kind of regime change crisis in Russia. Now, since that time, the prospects of regime change in Russia have faded away. They were never very great to start with, at least not in my opinion. And we hear a lot less about the Popular Front as a result. Personally, I should say that I know and have never met anyone involved in it. Having said that, it still exists and it's a useful umbrella organization for Putin and the Russian leadership to use in advance of parliamentary elections, which are due to take place in Russia in the autumn. And of course, its Congress also provides Putin with an opportunity to speak and to convey various messages that he wishes to convey to the Russian people. And the message that he sought to convey at this meeting was twofold. And it was an interesting message in its own respect. Now, he did speak, first of all, about the situation with the drone strikes against Russia. Over the course of this exhibition, he visited an exhibition where he viewed, amongst other things, a mock-up of the Panzer S anti-aircraft missile gun system. This is sometimes claimed to be the most effective point defense system in the world in terms of providing protection against specific targets and it is one that is extensively used by the Russians to combat drones. And over the course of his visit to this particular exhibit, he said this. This is what Putin said, according to the Russian TASS news agency. "We are modernizing the armed forces and achieving new results in the defense industrial sector and are moving forward. Our soldiers, our fighters are moving forward." And then he continued, "Russia will respond in kind to Ukraine's attacks and strikes will be much more powerful. Our response will always be tit for tat. No matter where inside Russia they attempt to strike, our retaliation will be much more powerful. And the enemy will feel that. Hopefully they are feeling that already, and they feel that on an increasingly larger scale." Now, this is an interesting comment for a number of reasons. Firstly, it clearly says that for the moment at least, the Russian leadership, Putin, the Russian political leadership, the Russian military leadership, have resolved to conduct retaliatory strikes following each Ukrainian attack, drone attack, on Russian territory. Secondly, that the retaliatory strikes will, at least for the time being, be held, conducted exclusively within the territory of Ukraine. But thirdly, the Russian strikes not only will be many times more powerful than the Ukrainian strikes on Russia, but they will continue to get more powerful with every iteration. In other words, the more the Russians strike at Ukraine in purported retaliation to Ukrainian strikes on Russia, the more the power of each of these Russian strikes on Ukraine will grow. Now, that is interesting, and it's interesting for various reasons. And let me first of all begin by saying that I think that Putin, like other Russian officials, like the Russian Ministry of Defense, are disingenuous. I don't believe Russian strikes on Ukraine are simply retaliatory strikes against Ukrainian attacks on Russia. I think and have always believed that they are part of a considered and carefully prepared plan worked out by the Russians over several years and carried out in order to weaken Ukraine as the Russian army itself advances on the battlefronts. And in fact, as I pointed out in a recent video, none other than the overall commander of the Russian armed forces fighting in Ukraine, General Valery Gerasimov, who also happens to be chief of the general staff, essentially said this. He said that the strikes that are being conducted against Ukraine are an integral part of the plan for carrying out the special military operation developed by the Russian general staff. So it has always been the Russian intention to carry out a steadily escalating succession of strikes against Ukraine, probably from this summer. Most likely, it has been coordinated with events in the ground offensive. But I suspect that one of the other factors that has made this campaign possible is that Russian industrial and military capabilities have now increased to the level where strikes of this kind an escalating series of ever more powerful strikes has become, for the first time, actually achievable. When the Russians began the special military operation back in 2022, they did already possess a significant stockpile of cruise missiles, KH-101s and Calibre cruise missiles, but these were subsonic. The Kinzhal missile had been brought into service and had started low-rate production, but the numbers of the Kinzhal missiles was relatively small. And of course, in those days, the Russians did not have mass drones or ability to launch mass drone strikes, because the Garand series family of drones at that time did not exist. And, well, I don't know how big the Russian stockpile of KH-101s and Calibre missiles was in 2022, but I'm guessing it ran into several hundred missiles, certainly not enough to conduct the kind of campaign of successive, ever more powerful strikes that Vladimir Putin is now talking about. So firstly, what has happened is that the Russians have undoubtedly increased production of their subsonic cruise missiles, the KH-101 and the Calibre. And they have, by the way, improved them over this period. Their stealth characteristics, their ability to deal with jamming has steadily increased over the period of the special military operation. But in many other respects, the Russians have now armed themselves with all kinds of weapons that they didn't have in 2022. So they have many, many more Kinzhal missiles today, and they're producing many more Kinzhal hypersonic missiles today than they did in 2022. The Iskander M ballistic missiles have entered service, are in apparently very high rates of production, are being used against Ukrainian targets all the time. In fact, the Iskander M appears in connection with many strikes to be the single most powerful missile system that the Russians routinely use. The Russians have also introduced another hypersonic system, the Tsirkon hypersonic cruise missile. This is apparently a system that was originally developed for use by the Russian Navy, but it is now also capable of being launched by ground launchers. It seems that Patriot missiles are useless against it, just to say. The Russians have obviously increased production of the Tsirkon, not just brought it into production, but have increased production of it by orders of magnitude. And it is now a regular feature of Russian strikes. And as I said, the Ukrainians have little warning of it and no ability to shoot it down. And the Russians have also produced other types of missiles, the KH-69 subsonic cruise missile launched from fighter jets, the Banderol stealth missile, much smaller missile, cruise missile, launched by Orion subsonic drones. These are similar to the American Reaper drones, just to say they're basically the Russian equivalent, though they're rather smaller. But anyway, the point about these is that these Orion drones can be deployed quite stealthily in all sorts of locations in Ukraine, and then can suddenly launch one of these missiles, which are themselves stealthy, from various unexpected locations. And of course, the Russians now have vast numbers of drones, Geran drones, which, as I pointed out, now come in many different versions, with the most advanced being the Geran 4 jet-powered drone with the optical guidance system, which I have suggested is perhaps integrated in some way with the Russian Rasvet satellite array in a similar way to the way in which Ukrainian drones that strike inside Russia are integrated and obtain their signals from the American Starlink system. So we have seen an enormous industrial effort, and it has increasingly borne fruit in the form of these devastating strikes that the Russians are now able to launch. And these strikes are not only devastating in the sense that they can destroy large industrial facilities, power stations, and things of that kind. That is something that the Russians have done at various times since 2022. But the Geran drones can be used to attack much smaller targets, targets which you would not normally use an expensive missile to attack and destroy. And of course, what I'm talking about here are the hundreds of gasoline filling stations in eastern Ukraine that the Russians have destroyed, mostly with Geran 4 drones. So that's one thing that has happened. Of course, there is something else, and that is the continued enigma, which is the Oreshnik system. I've received eye-watering accounts about the number of these systems that the Russians are producing. I'm going to say straightforwardly that I think that when Putin talks about missile strikes and drone strikes against Ukraine becoming steadily more powerful, he is clearly hinting here at the Oreshnik system. All of the missiles that I have described, especially perhaps the Iskander and the Kinzhal, will do considerable damage to any targets they hit, but none, of course, can do the kind of damage that the much bigger, far more powerful Oreshnik system can do. And when Putin talks about strikes that are becoming far more powerful and will become more powerful still, it seems to me that it is the Oreshnik ultimately that he is talking about. So anyway, this is what we see with the strikes that have taken place and which Putin says will continue to take place. There will be, and this is the message we should take from Putin's words, continuous escalation by the Russians of the war in the sky, with the Russians conducting increasingly powerful attacks against Ukraine, even as Ukraine's own attacks against Russia start to reduce in impact. Now, the last comment is, of course, going to be controversial. Suffice to say that last night, Ukraine did conduct another big drone strike against Moscow. Indeed, according to the Russians, according to the Russian authorities, it was the biggest drone strike against Moscow that Ukraine has conducted up to now. At least biggest in terms of the sheer numbers of drones used. By some estimates, around 300 drones, all directed at Russia. The problem is that it seems that none got through. Most of the drones were apparently brought down by the Russian air defences. In the fields, over the fields and forests of Western Russia. Some of them, however, managed to make it to the Moscow region, where quite a few were shot down. A small number, this is of course according to the Russian authorities, reached the outskirts of Moscow, where, however, they were all brought down. No major industrial facility was apparently attacked or damaged. No major building or well-known landmark in Moscow was attacked or damaged. My guess is that the population of central Moscow will have seen no evidence that this strike even took place. That is not to say that there weren't some losses as a result of this strike. As I said in the past, it looks as if the Russians mostly aim to shoot down the Ukrainian drones over the countryside and over the outskirts of the cities that the Ukrainians target. This is probably why all of the people in Russia I have spoken to who have seen these drones invariably have seen them from their dachas, their country homes, if you wish, which in Russia tend to be concentrated in what are called dacha communities that you find in clusters around all the big Russian cities. And it seems that several Ukrainian drones were brought down over one of these clusters, and there's lots of footage of fire and damage done to these houses, these country houses, in this particular location, and it appears that several people were killed. I am not going to say more about this because, well, I don't have the full details, and a lot more will come out in due course. Suffice to say that I am confident that the Ukrainians were not aiming to attack this particular settlement. I can't imagine that there would be any purpose or reason to do it, even if the Ukrainians were aiming to cause civilian casualties. They would not see any purpose in attacking and causing these casualties in a small settlement. They would be aiming at Moscow itself. That at least seems to me obvious. Anyway, my overall sense is that for the moment at least, the Russians have got on top of the big Ukrainian strikes deep within their country, aiming at their cities and aiming at their oil refineries and other big industrial facilities. Now, on the southern battlefronts, on the front lines in Zaporozhye and Kherson regions, in Crimea, and of course in the Sea of Azov, it is a different story. Here, the Ukrainian drones have a much shorter distance to travel. That means they can carry a bigger explosive charge. It means that the Russians have less advance warning that they are coming. And of course, the drone swarms are much bigger because they won't have suffered the attrition, the losses that they suffer as they try to reach Moscow, deep inside Russia. However, having said all of this, if we're talking about Crimea and Zaporozhye region, I am starting, well, I haven't, for a while I've been getting the sense that the effectiveness of Ukraine's drones may be reducing here as well. And this may explain why the Ukrainians have been recently focused on carrying out attacks on shipping in the Sea of Azov. And there is no doubt, none whatsoever, that the Ukrainians have managed to conduct a significant number of strikes on ships. Now, what the exact damage that is being done by these strikes is, I think, is controversial. I've already said that drones are unlikely to cause much damage to tankers or container ships or ships carrying cargoes like grain. Ships are big, strong things, made of steel, mostly. They can absorb a significant amount of damage from what are relatively small drones. The Ukrainians are claiming scores, hundreds of ships in the Sea of Azov as having been destroyed. There may have been hundreds of hits with drones on ships, though even of that I cannot speak with certainty. But that does not mean that hundreds of ships have been destroyed. Several ships may have been very badly damaged if they were hit by large numbers of drones. Whether any ship has actually been sunk, I am not sure. I've been away over the last few days, and I am not fully up to date with the whole story. My suspicion, and it is a suspicion, is one of the reasons why the Ukrainians have been focusing so much on attacks on shipping in the Sea of Azov is that it is much more difficult here for the Russians to first counter these strikes and secondly to rebut information about the effectiveness of these strikes, whereas the Ukrainians are able to provide film footage of their drones hitting these tankers and making big bangs and flashes and clouds of smoke and all of those things. Anyway, there might be an element of media manipulation to this story too, though I want to stress again, I'm not there and I've been out of touch with things, and it may be that this campaign against the ships is having more effect than I am currently aware of. I doubt, however, that even on the most optimistic, or if you are from the Russian side, worst perspective, they're having as much damage, anywhere near as much damage, as some people think. And, well, I read a report in Reuters that said that the Russians have closed the Sea of Azov to shipping, which is possible, but I have long since come to have entertain skepticism about reports by Reuters, just to say. Pains me to say this, but it's true. And I don't consider Reuters a fully reliable source on this kind of thing. Certainly, I have not seen in any official Russian publication any mention of a stop to shipping on the Sea of Azov. Assuming that there has been, what effect exactly on Russia is that going to have? Mariupol is an important port. The Russians do export grain, for example, from Mariupol. There are other ports in the Black Sea through which the Russians could also export grain if they were to make that decision. There are probably other ports in the Baltic, for example, from which the Russians could export grain from as well. If it is grain cargoes that the Ukrainians aren't attacking, as many people suggest. Oil tankers, it's the same. Again, the Russians do have alternative routes. Mariupol is an important port. It is not the biggest or the most important port in Russia. And the maritime traffic that passes through it is not so large as to have a critical effect on the Russian economy. For the record, as I understand it, as the latest figures appear to show, Russian crude oil exports are now close to their historic peak. So these attacks don't seem to be having much of an effect on Russia's oil export trade. Anyway, now, having said all of this, the Russians, as I said, are conducting big attacks. Putin talked about tit-for-tat attacks. The Russians have been conducting very heavy attacks on the port of Odessa. Odessa, in my opinion, has been under essential blockade by the Russians for many, many months now. And the attacks on the port of Odessa will have made export by Ukraine from Odessa extremely difficult. If one compares Russia's situation with Ukraine's, as I said, Mariupol is an important port for Russia, but not a vital port. Whereas for Ukraine, Odessa is the only really large important port that it has. If Mariupol is closed and the Sea of Azov is closed, Russia will get by and the economic difficulty will be real but limited. If Odessa is closed, then Ukraine has no means for seaborne export. That is the fundamental difference that many people, I think, don't grasp about these strikes. Putting aside the far greater power of Russian weapon systems, Russia is an enormous country, the biggest in the world. Ukraine's ability to damage this enormous country to a degree that would really affect its economic performance is very limited. Ukraine is, after Russia, the second biggest country in Europe. It does have a very large territory, but it is territory which the Russians can fully cover. And unlike Ukraine, they can do massive damage upon it because from a Russian perspective, the area of operations is relatively limited. Again, I sense that this is not something that people fully understand. And anyway, it is certainly not something that is widely reported about in the West. Now, since I'm on the topic of big Russian strikes, in my previous programme, the programme I made prior to my travels back to London, I mentioned that there were rumours about a big Russian combined drone and missile strike coming, and that strike duly came, though it was not on the scale of some of the other big Russian strikes that we have seen over the course of this month. One of the targets of this strike was, however, a drone factory in the Kiev region. Now, according to official reports, shortly before this drone strike, this missile and drone strike on this drone factory took place, the factory hosted an important visitor in the person of Senator Lindsey Graham of the United States. Now, Senator Graham has been to Kiev, where he had a meeting with President Zelensky. Coming out of that meeting, he discussed the plan to move forward, for the Senate to move forward with a bone-crushing sanctions bill that Senator Graham and Senator Blumenthal have been working on since the summer of last year. I discussed all of this extensively in my previous video. And then again, according to the official report, Senator Graham travelled back to the United States, arrived in Washington, and a few hours later died suddenly of a heart attack. Now, I have no information that contradicts this official story, but there have been many rumours, and I want to stress rumours, that what actually caused Senator Graham to die was not the heart attack in Washington, but the strike on the drone factory, the Russian strike on the drone factory, which Senator Graham had himself visited. Supposedly, Senator Graham himself was caught up in that attack. I have to say that I don't myself place much weight on this theory. At Sonar 21, Larry Johnson, the superb commentator and former US intelligence official, has pointed out that there are problems with the official narrative, in that it's difficult to understand how Senator Graham was able to get so quickly from Kiev to Washington, given that he would have had to take a train from Kiev to Warsaw and then fly from Warsaw to Washington, with the flight itself taking around 10 hours. So, yes, there are problems and issues with the story. I'm not going to second guess them. And I'm also going to, I should also say that I found some of the accounts of Senator Graham's last meetings in Washington with various American interlocutors very revealing and plausible and therefore likely true. I am not going to say more about this. I don't personally think Senator Graham died in this missile strike. I don't pretend I know the full facts. Maybe the right thing we should do is wait for any announcement from the American authorities which would cast more light on the matter. But until I see that information, I'm going to ride with the theory that he did indeed die as a result of a heart attack, and did so in Washington. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about him, about his death, rather. I would say that for me, Senator Graham is a perfect example of the neocon paradox, in that his influence and power in Washington has steadily grown, even as the foreign policy courses he has consistently advocated have been marked by consistent failure. But anyway, I've been saying this for many years now, and perhaps talking about this directly following the death of a man might not be the right thing to do. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say about Senator Graham. About the strikes on Kiev, however, we have had more information. I'm not sure whether information is the right word, but more commentary about the massive strike by the Russians on the facility that supposedly housed the depleted uranium shells and the cluster munitions close to Kiev, and which caused this enormous explosion, which destroyed did immense damage to an entire Kiev micro district. The Ukrainian authorities, it seems to me, are being very evasive about this affair. They're failing to provide any proper explanation as to exactly what happened. They appear to be denying that this was an arms dump, though they're not making it at all clear what, in that case, this was. I think it is urgent that they do provide information, and that Western governments press them for it, and Western agencies do so, because, of course, storing ammunition during a war, especially in a populated area, I understand can be considered a war crime. Putting aside whether that is correct, it certainly appears to me incredibly reckless and irresponsible a thing to do. Anyway, the big attack on Kiev that took place the night, shall we say, the night before Senator Graham died, again illustrates, however, one further important fact. Kiev no longer has, to all intents and purposes, air defences. The air defence that Kiev has is either made up of short-range missiles, cannon, and occasional forays by Ukrainian fighter jets trying to shoot down Russian drones. The ability to shoot down Russian missiles essentially no longer exists. So Kiev is now open to strikes by the Russians, and that takes us back to what Putin was saying about the Russian strikes becoming more and more powerful. And I've already discussed in many programs the massive shortage of Patriot missile interceptors, the fact that it is inconceivable that the United States is going to send any more Patriot missile interceptors to Ukraine, especially now when it is back involved in a renewed conflict in the Persian Gulf. And the story about Ukraine producing the Patriot missile under license, even some Western commentators are now beginning to understand that in the short term, at least, this is a fantasy one which doesn't remotely address Ukraine's current problems. The absence of an organized air defense system around Kiev is important. Now, Professor Theodor Postol has again done a program in which he says that, in his firm view, the Patriot missile system is incapable of shooting down ballistic missiles. The story that the Patriot missile system is able to shoot down Iskander-M missiles, for example, is a myth. That may be true, but the Patriot missile system can, of course, shoot down aircraft. And I suspect that one of the purposes of the Patriot missile batteries around Kiev was not just to protect Kiev from Russian missiles, subsonic cruise missiles, drones, such things, but also to protect Kiev from Russian aviation, from Russian bombers. Because the Russian bombers are now extremely active right across the front lines, dropping big, powerful FAB bombs practically everywhere. The number of sorties that the Russians do has increased to very, very large numbers. I believe something like 8,000 sorties in a period of about a week. I might be getting that completely wrong. If so, I apologize. But certainly up to the level of what one would normally see the US Air Force do. And the absence of a functioning air defense system around Kiev means that Russian Sukhoi 34 bombers can now approach Kiev itself and can launch FAB bombs carrying tremendous explosive charges, far greater than those of any missile, and much greater, of course, than a drone, a Garand drone, that the Russians can start launching FAB strikes on Kiev itself. And in my opinion, it is only a question of time before the Russians start to do it. No less a person than President Zelensky himself has admitted that Ukraine, to all intents and purposes, no longer has an air defense system. And if you go to Larry Johnson's Sonar 21 Substack site, you'll see an article there made by an eyewitness of the situation in Kiev, which is harrowing enough. But perhaps the most upsetting thing that I saw was a picture of a metro station in Kiev crowded with people during a Russian strike, apparently in place of deep shelters. This now, during the Russian strikes, is where much of the population of Kiev now hides. Now, again, we've heard an awful lot about the strikes on Moscow, but I have never seen any picture of the Moscow metro being used in this way. Anyway, that's the situation with the war in the sky. Now, at this meeting with the Popular Front, Putin did have something else to say, and it was very interesting. And it was this. People often ask, how is it that the entire Russophobic, so-called aggressive part of the so-called collective West is fighting us while we develop our economy, strengthen our finances, improve our armed forces, achieve new results in the defense industry, and move forward? Our guys, our fighters, are moving forward. How is this possible? And then he goes on to say, in part, this is thanks to your effort, in other words, to the Popular Front. You rallied more than 20 million people, citizens of Russia, and raised, not from the state, but from other citizens voluntarily, and donated nearly 70 billion rubles to the SMO. That's how it works. That's why victory awaits us, without a doubt. Now, one can be a little cynical about some parts of this. I don't think that Russia has been able to do all of the things that Putin listed because of the activities of the Popular Front, the People's Front, at least not even to the extent that he said. But what are Putin's words here, if not his statement about the importance of Russia successfully maintaining the atmosphere of normalcy within Russian society? Normalcy is the term I come up with to describe the situation in Russia, which I saw when I was there a month ago. The fact that, to all appearances, for someone who did not know that the country was at war, it gave the impression of living through a prosperous and stable peace. Now, I've said in various programs that this looked to me to be part of Putin's strategy, his calculation that Russia would win the war in Ukraine, provided it maintained its own internal stability, and that this is why he has worked so hard to achieve and successfully achieve this quality of normalcy in Russia itself. But if you go back to these words that Putin said to the People's Front, how is it that the entire Russophobic so-called aggressive part of the so-called collective West is fighting us whilst we develop our economy, strengthen our finances, improve our armed forces, achieve new results in defence industry and move forward? How is this possible? When you listen to those words, I personally could not escape the impression that for Putin, achieving normalcy, maintaining normalcy in Russia during the war is a victory in itself. It tells the world, it tells the Russian people, look, the West is not as strong as you believe. We are not as weak as we have feared. We are able to get on with our lives, despite the fact that the West is doing so much to ruin things for us. So we need to be proud of that and confident of our success in the future. Now, Putin has probably not thought this through in quite the way that I am going to suggest, but it does make a certain sense if, like me, you believe that the one key ingredient that Russia has been missing up to now in order to fully succeed is confidence. What Putin is doing by maintaining normalcy in Russia is that he is creating confidence, a sense of stability, a sense that tomorrow will be as good as or even better than today. A confidence that leads to people setting up businesses and investing their money in those businesses and planning forward. And since I brought up the topic of investment, I can remember a time not so long ago when Russia was investing around 15% of its GDP, which is very much on the low side. And the latest figures show that it is now investing around 26% of its GDP, which is, by the way, high. Not as high as we have seen in some countries, not as high as we see in China, though China has a different economic model and is arguably at a different stage in its development, but certainly higher than one is likely to see in Europe today. So anyway, I just wanted to say that. It's a point that nobody makes, though I do personally think it is very important, and I suspect it explains even more about the overall situation in the war and in terms of the policies that Vladimir Putin is following. Now, let us actually return to the topic of the war itself, because there's been another very extraordinary article, at least I find it extraordinary, in the Financial Times about the Battle of Konstantinovka. And the fascinating thing about this particular article is that it assumes that the battle for Konstantinovka is still underway, that the Russians are probably winning the battle, but that overall the battle is still being fought and Konstantinovka overall continues to remain in Ukrainian control. Now, to my mind, this is, well, it is completely absurd. I have absolutely no doubt that Konstantinovka is indeed fully controlled by the Russians. But, well, there we are. We see how, in the case of the Financial Times, they have up to now resisted discussion about the situation in Konstantinovka. They did an article a little while back sort of admitting that Konstantinovka was indeed an important place. But anyway, they don't want to admit yet that it has been captured. The title of the article, by the way, is Russia Closes In on City That Made the Kremlin Glitter. I think in one of the articles that I, one of the videos that I published a short while ago, I mentioned that the ruby domes, the ruby stars above the Kremlin were apparently made in Konstantinovka. This article confirms that fact. But then it says that now Vladimir Putin is trying to take the city that made Moscow glitter, even if his forces have to reduce it to rubble first. Russian troops are grinding towards Konstantinovka from three directions, pressing ahead with the president's goal of seizing Ukraine's Donbass region, despite heavy casualties. And then we're told one of the main advantages Russia has over Ukraine is manpower, the ability to replenish and tolerate very high losses. And this has been said by Emil Kastehelmi of the Finland-based Blackbird Conflict Analysis Group, which tells us that Ukraine actually captured more territory last month than Russia did. Anyway, that's what he is saying. And we're then told that Konstantinivka is an important link in Ukraine's so-called fortress belt, which stretches north through the urban cities of Druzhkovo, Kramatorsk, Slovyansk and Liman, and protects what remains of Kiev-held Donbass. Its fall would put those other cities in the region under greater pressure and could give Russia a foothold for a deeper offensive into the sparsely populated lowlands to the west. Points that, of course, I've been making since the start of the special military operation and have also been discussed very extensively, sometimes on programmes on the Duran by Stanislav Krapivnik. Anyway, I find it all absolutely bewildering, truly astonishing, that the Financial Times cannot acknowledge what video footage has confirmed beyond all reasonable doubt that the Russians already control Konstantinivka. And they don't just control Konstantinivka. As I've discussed in several programmes, they control Liman as well, though they have not yet confirmed this fact. That, at least, is my belief. Our old friend, Andrei Marochko, has told us the probable reason why the Russians have not so far announced the capture of Liman, and that is that the Ukrainians have been conducting counterattacks in the area of Liman, trying to, as Marochko says, recover lost positions. Marochko says that all of these counterattacks have failed and that their intensity is declining, which suggests that the battle for Liman is indeed now all but over. Anyway, this is, of course, consistent with what the Ukrainians also did in Konstantinivka. There, too, Ukraine conducted counterattacks, as we now know, and tried to break back into the city. But again, according to the Russians, the attack was unsuccessful. Now, there's been many more reports about what's been going on across the conflict lines. There's reports about the Russians gaining more ground in Sumy region as they gradually move to encircle the city of Sumy, of how the Russians have been strengthening their attack on the small town of Beli Kolodis in Kharkiv region, which would give the Russians a significant chunk of Kharkiv region were it captured. I've already discussed the situation in Liman. It seems that the Russians have been pushing forward westwards from Kupiansk towards a large reservoir that is located to the west of Kupiansk. Of course, Putin talked about this about 3 weeks ago. And the Russians also have been steadily edging closer and closer to Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. And it looks like the attack on these two towns is gradually developing, with some speculation in some parts of the independent media world that the Russians are going to attack Kramatorsk before they attack Slavyansk. And in Konstantinivka itself, the Russians have apparently, this is according to the Russian Defense Ministry, advanced from Konstantinivka without stop. They've started a big storming operation in Druzhivka, the town to the south of Konstantinivka, and the battle, apparently, for Druzhivka is now underway. Lastly, in the Orekhov region, there is now fighting going on for a small town called Yubertsi, located in the steppe north of Orekhov. Judging from the maps, if the Russian forces advancing from the east towards the city of Zaporozhye do succeed in capturing this place, then they will be in a strong position to cut the supply roads to Orekhov, which are probably by now mostly unusable anyway, and to begin the operation to capture this, to capture Orekhov itself. Anyway, that's the military situation as far as I can see it on the front lines. Meanwhile, all sorts of strange things continue to happen in the world of global energy. Firstly, it remains the case that Europe's gas reserve situation remains uncomfortable. The gas reserves in Europe are nowhere close to being filled for the winter, the coming winter. Europe has responded to this by increasing purchases of LNG from Russia. So even and as European governments, the EU, imposes sanctions, more and more sanctions, on Russian energy, and says that it will cease to import Russian energy products of any kind after January 2027. And even as the EU and the Europeans work to help the Ukrainians conduct strikes on Russian energy facilities, Europe continues to fund the Russian energy complex by ramping up purchases of Russian LNG. Apparently, last month, sales by Russia of LNG to Europe grew by 18%. Now, there is a lot of controversy as to whether why the Russians themselves do this. And there is criticism of this in Russia. But just briefly, I believe that this is an industry matter. I think the gas production and export companies, Gazprom, Novatek and the others, wield considerable influence. After all, they pay significant amounts to the budget. They've not yet sorted out all of their plans with their Asian customers. They need the bridge that continued exports of gas to Europe provides them until those arrangements with Asia are finalised. There's rumours, by the way, there's again rumours that the final issues with Power of Siberia 2 will be resolved in September between China and Russia. Well, we shall see. But anyway, I can understand the rational calculations why the Russians might choose to sell LNG to the West. I can understand the criticisms as well. I'm not saying the criticisms are wrong, but I can see why business people in Russia, in the gas industry, might want to continue with these sales for the moment. But given that we are running short of gas in Europe, given that we could be facing major price hikes in Europe in the autumn, given the effect that this is going to have on living standards and on inflation and on the state of public finances, which is already very bad in Europe, why, oh why, are we in Europe pressing forward with banning imports of Russian energy products and assisting the Ukrainians to attack Russian energy facilities, even as we import energy from Russia? To me, I mean, this absolutely fails to make any kind of sense at all. And yet that, nonetheless, is what European and Western governments are currently doing. And they're not only doing that. The US government, of course, is now back in conflict with Iran about the Persian Gulf. As my friend and colleague Alex Christoforou has rightly pointed out, the war that Iran and the United States fought in February and March and early April was purportedly a conflict over Iran's nuclear enrichment program. We hardly hear anything about that anymore. This current conflict is not about Iran's nuclear enrichment program. It is about who controls the Strait of Hormuz, whether it's the Americans and their friends, or whether it's the Iranians. And the reason for the return to war and the falling out between Iran and the United States, despite the signing of the MOU, is precisely because the Iranians were becoming very unhappy by the way in which the United States seemed to be trying to negate Iran's control of the Strait of Hormuz. So, given that we have this crisis, that the Strait of Hormuz is closed, the US CENTCOM command said that the Strait of Hormuz is open and any ship that wants can pass through with the protection of the US military. Then a few hours later, we got reports that, in fact, the actual transit of ships through the Strait of Hormuz has all but stopped. Anyway, given that the Strait of Hormuz is closed and that oil exports through the Strait of Hormuz have indeed stopped, again, I ask the question, why in the West, why is the West still waging this conflict against the Russian energy system through its Ukrainian proxy, given that it depends increasingly now on Russian energy to keep the wheels of the global economy turning? It seems, at least not the global economy, the Western economy turning. It really does seem most odd. And, well, I don't see something which is even more remarkable, any debate at all about this question in Europe. On the contrary, there continues to be cheering on of the Ukrainian attacks on the Russian energy system. And, well, I've come to the conclusion that there is an element of desperation about all of this. The war in Donbass is being lost. The overall war in Ukraine is being lost. Ukraine can't get air defense systems anymore. The hope that there's going to be regime change in Moscow has dribbled away. The hope that pressure on Russia would force it to change course has gradually gone away too. So there is this last desperate throw, attacks Russia using drones, to attack refineries. That's the last big throw left before the curtain falls. And that might, by the way, in part explain the strange euphoria, because I have noticed in the past, in personal matters and in business matters, that when basically all real hope dies, people sometimes do cope with it by retreating into a kind of strange euphoria, an optimism that all will turn out well, and build enormous amounts of wishful thinking based on very little. Of course, the doubt beneath the surface is always there. And this strange article in the Financial Times about Konstantinovka, admitting that Konstantinovka is about to fall, acknowledging its strategic importance, acknowledging the fact that its fall opens the way for the Russians to advance through the remaining fortified towns in Donbass, and that the fall of Donbass in turn opens up the operational space for the Russians to advance through the sparsely occupied lowlands beyond, just to say. So they know all of that, but that's not really what they want to acknowledge. They admit that Konstantinovka is likely to fall, even as it has already fallen for at least a week, and still tell themselves that all will be well, that Putin is isolated, that nobody wants to talk to him, that the trip he made to China presumably never happened, that Lavrov's tour of Africa really doesn't mean anything. They don't want to talk about any of that, and instead they comfort themselves with their daydreams. As I said, it does happen in life. I've seen it happen many times, but never quite to this degree. Anyway, this is where I'm going to finish today's program. Let me remind you, you can find all our programs on on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. You can support our work by Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.